This is a Main Hustle Media podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is Jackie O and you're listening to Militantly Mixed.
Yo, this is Rashani from the Single Simulcast. And when I'm not making you laugh or making up parody songs, I'm kicking back, listening to Militantly Mixed.
Main Hustle Media podcasts are recorded on the ancestral lands of the Chumash, Tongva, Hohokam, and Yucateco Maya people, and we wish to pay our respects to the people of those nations, both past and present. Konnichi, what's up, cousins? Welcome to Militantly Mixed, the podcast about race and identity from the mixed race perspective. I am your sir auntie, Charmaine Fury, aka The Blasian Blurred, and this is episode 212. I'm going to hit you with two fair warnings during this intro. The first of which is, this is probably going to be a long intro. You know, like old school long Charmaine intros, because I got some things I need to say. Or want to say. Maybe it's not important that I say, but I'm going to say them. The second fair warning will be a trigger warning about the episode, but I'm not going to get into that yet. I'm going to get into the shit I need to rant about first, and then I will get into that later on. So, fair warning. This is going to be a long intro. This is episode 212, and it will air on June 19th, which, for those of you in my international audience, some of you may be aware, some of you may not. I know you're more aware of things that happen in the U.S. than most of you U.S. Americans are aware of things that happen in the rest of the world. Juneteenth is the holiday that commemorates and acknowledges the essential, and I say that in quotation fingers, end to chattel slavery in the United States. Now, emancipation happened on January 1st, 1863. That's when it was issued. That's when it went into effect. But enslavers in Texas thought they were cute and was like, we're hella far from D.C. Who's even going to know? We need some more harvests. We're not going to tell them they're free. Now, did they know? Yes. Did they tell their enslaved people? No, they did not. So it wasn't until 2.5 years later that Union General Gordon Granger landed in Galveston and started to share the Emancipation Proclamation with enslaved Africans. So sometime between June 12th and June 19th is when the news started to get out. And the history is that when the enslaved Africans found out, they pulled together their food and their beverages, and they dressed in red, and they had a multi-day celebration honoring and commemorating the end to their enslavement. You may have heard me say on the show in the past that I am a direct descendant of these enslaved Africans. My family is from enslaved Africans in Texas, and we always celebrated Juneteenth. My literal family has celebrated this day for 158 years. Now, my great-grandparents left Texas in the early 1900s, earlier than mid, but not early, I guess, if that makes sense. But they still raised their children and grandchildren, and in my case, great-grandchildren, to celebrate this day. I was one of the only black people I knew, only black families I knew, that celebrated this day. I would tell people about this, and they never heard of it before. And the only other black people that we knew also celebrated it would be the ones we invited to come to our celebration. In fact, it wasn't until I was an adult that I finally met another black person that celebrated Juneteenth outside of Texas. That's how uninformed people were about this day. Flash forward to last year, it became a federal holiday, and it has already become a bastardization of what the actual day is and the meaning behind it. And it's even worse, because now that it's a federal holiday, even non-descendants of an African enslavement get the day off and think it's an excuse to go to the beach. So here's where my rant begins. I've been seeing some stuff on the internet over the last few days of people, Juneteenth, and trying to be woke and shit like that or whatever, and doing it in the worst way possible. So the personal side of this day for me, being a direct descendant, is, man, I wish no one fucking knew about this thing. You know, I want to keep it to the purity that I felt it was when I was growing up. That being said, I want this day to be accessible to all the descendants of African enslaved people in the United States. And I'm not going to hide this. I want it to only be accessible to the descendants of enslaved Africans in the United States. For us, it is a day of rest and commemoration and honoring our ancestors and fellowship. And while I hate this term and I hate that we have to be this, acknowledging the resiliency of us as Black people in the United States. If white people can just take the day off to go to the beach, fuck you. Like, you know, I don't know. I don't like it. It makes me very upset. So here's what I've said for years, and I will continue to say. In fact, I just saw my Facebook post about this from a couple years ago, and I was like, oh man, I've been saying this for years. If you are the descendant of enslaved Africans in the United States, but especially Texas, you rest. You fellowship. You celebrate. You eat barbecue. You do whatever that honors you and the people who came before you. And if your job tries to not let you take the day off or forces you to use it as a floating holiday, I mean, fuck them. I don't know. I want to fight that shit. You should get the day off. You should be paid. You shouldn't have any pressure. You shouldn't have to talk about it. And I don't care if you're mixed or monoracial Black or whatever. If you are the descendant of enslaved Africans in the United States, and in particular Texas, this is your day. If, as a mixed descendant of enslaved Africans, you don't have that much access to this day, you don't know much about it, today could be a day of education for you. But it doesn't mean that it is not a day of celebration for you. I don't care how someone will try to hit you with the percentages or whatever. If you are the descendant of enslaved Africans in this country, in the United States, this is your day of rest and honoring of the people who came before us. If you are not the descendant of enslaved Africans in the United States, this is a day of education and service to the Black community whilst not taking up space in the Black community. And you may say, well, how do I be of service to Black people without taking up space? It's a listening time. It's a shut up time. It's a serve time. It is not a, I'm here, I'm an ally, let me ally you the way I want to ally you. Mm-mm. This is a listen, shut up, and serve kind of day. If that's too much for you, then it is an education kind of day, which still does involve listening and shutting up. You can pay with your own money a Black practitioner of anti-racism education, and I mean pay. Not go on their TikTok and get their free information blurbs or their Instagrams or whatever. Enroll in their courses, their workshops, what have you. Do the work. Do the work on your own racism. Internalized or otherwise. Because even those of us who are mixed with Black have internalized racism. White supremacy is insidious and it has trained us how to harm ourselves. So we have a lot of work to do too. But if you are not the descendant of enslaved Africans on Juneteenth, it is not a beach day. It is an opportunity for you to learn. It is an opportunity for you to serve the Black community. And it is an opportunity to make real steps towards changing the systems that are in place that continue to, if not, technically enslave us, legally kind of enslave us. So don't be posting no fucking Juneteenth hashtags at the beach when you're not a direct descendant. of enslaved Africans in the United States. If that sounds personal, it's because I have a private message call out that I had to do. So, yeah. Anyways, I'm not going to get into that on the show, but shit pissed me off. So, yeah. Anyways, I just wanted to put it out there. In terms of Juneteenth and Militantly Mix, fun fact, Juneteenth 2018 was the date that the Militantly Mix trailer dropped. The first announcement publicly that Militantly Mix, the podcast, was about to start happening, dropped on Juneteenth 2018. Hella intentional. I was acknowledging the freedom of my ancestors through a chosen freedom to become a mixed race podcaster at a time when there weren't any active mixed race podcasts. It was an act of liberation. It was an act of freedom. And I wasn't ready to actually release the show on Juneteenth. Plus, it being a more general mixed race show versus a specifically a black show, I also wanted to separate the anniversary from Juneteenth. That being said, trailer dropped on Juneteenth. 2019, I did my first Juneteenth episode. I think 2020, I did one also. And I will continue to always acknowledge Juneteenth publicly. It is an important day in my own direct ancestry, but also important to Black people in the United States at large. This is the first year that I will be living not in the United States for Juneteenth. And I am going to be attending a Juneteenth event that will be put on here by some of the people in a Black expat group that I'm in. It'll be my first social outing, really, with strangers, I guess, since I've been here, which I'm really looking forward to. But it also marks a change in the way I approach going forward how I acknowledge and celebrate this day. There will always be the aspect of it that's important to me as the direct descendant of enslaved Africans in Texas, and even more so the first Juneteenth. But this year I chose liberation. I chose my own liberation. I decided to leave the country that I was born in to live in a place that I would not necessarily experience some of the same disenfranchisement that I experienced in the United States. That doesn't mean I won't experience any disenfranchisement. That doesn't mean I won't experience any racism. But I have experienced freedoms from a lot of the symbolic shackles of the United States just in the few months that I've been here. And so I'm looking forward to adding a new aspect to the way I acknowledge and celebrate this day as a person that is currently living in a country I wasn't born in. So I'll tell you all how it goes next week, because it's not happening until later on tonight. But I'm excited. I'm really excited about it. So anyways, that was my rant. I take Juneteenth very personal, obviously, but I don't want it to get messy out there. Don't get messy out there. Okay, moving on. I have a trigger warning that I have to hit you all with at the start of this before we get into today's episode. My guest today is Victoria Pendragon. She is the author of the upcoming memoir, Scorpio Times 10. And in her memoir and in our conversation, she and I talk pretty heavily about child abuse, sexual assault, incest, and sex trafficking. And the ways in which what happened to her is a direct relation to a family member's racism and treatment of her and her sisters that appeared more obviously Cuban versus the sisters that appeared more obviously white. What happened to her did not happen to the white sisters, but did happen to the brown ones. Some of the brown ones. You'll hear about that later too. So the trigger warning is for folks that don't feel like they can hear about, especially if you are a victim yourself of similar things and you're not in a place where you can really hear other people talk about their situation. For those of you who don't have that in your past and you still think it might be a little bit difficult, I still would really love you all to listen to this episode, because I have never had and accidentally keeping up with the theme of liberation, I have never had a more liberating conversation about childhood abuse and sexual assault that I experienced with another person who also has experienced similar things, not the same, but similar, than I have had in this conversation with Victoria. And I've been thinking about her ever since we recorded it. Another, I guess, like kind of warning, but y'all might be already kind of aware of this if you've listened to me for a long time. One of my coping mechanisms is that I laugh through talking about really heavy, horrible shit that has happened to me. This is something that I've talked to other therapists about over the course of the last 30 years on and off, and almost all of them that I remember addressing this with have agreed this is a very common coping mechanism, and there's nothing wrong with it. It just can be really off-putting to someone who hasn't experienced what we've had to hear us laughing through really horrible shit or talking about it in such a disconnected kind of way that it seems like we're describing a movie scene instead of describing something that actually happened to us. That is also a defense mechanism. And guess what? Both she and I have the same defense mechanisms. And as a result of that, I had one of the most, if not the most, freeing conversations about child abuse and sexual assault that I've ever had in my life. Because I was able to have it with someone who I didn't have to fear judgment in expressing what I was about to express. And likewise, she did not have to fear that from me either. We could say things that might on the outside seem like an irrational response to something that happened to us, but we got it. We understood what the other one was saying when they were saying what they were saying. And walked away from that conversation being like, no, I fucking get it. It sounds crazy, but I fucking get it. And that is what I'm trying to say, why this episode is so important. Because I've never experienced anything like this, and I can only imagine that if I could hear two people who suffered some of the things that she and I suffered talk in this sort of matter-of-fact, slightly disconnected, and kind of laughing through some of the pain aspects, and walk away not judging each other. I've been thinking about it. It's been two weeks. I've been thinking about it ever since. So I want to thank Victoria for giving me that. I mean, she was coming on the show to talk about her book and to talk about her past experiences, and for that critical part of the conversation, which is specifically, it's because of the grandfather's racism that what happened to her happened to her. And how this happens in our families. And this is another reason why it's so important. Because you might be able to now pay attention to some shit that happens in your actual family. I'm not saying all of our families are like this. Some of our families have this shit in us. And a lot of us look away from it. But getting a chance to talk to Victoria, I swear it was such a liberating experience. And I don't need to dwell on what happened to me in the past. I've been in therapy on and off for 30 years. I'm not even dealing with that shit in therapy, in the most recent therapy I've had. I'm dealing with other shit now. That's why I can talk about it with somewhat of a removal. Doesn't mean it doesn't hurt or it doesn't suck that that shit happened. It's just that I can talk about it differently now through all those years of therapy than I could have talked about it 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And I think it's important to hear people have that experience. I think it's important to know that you can get to a place eventually after trauma where you don't have to dwell on it, but you can still share about it if it is to help other people. And I think that's what we were both trying to do. Her in writing the memoir to help people and to close the door on it. And me in also just, hey, guess what? I've experienced some of what you're talking about too. Let's talk about it. So it was amazing. And I do want y'all to listen to it. I understand there's going to be a few people that probably won't be able to. But if you can try, please do. Because it was an amazing conversation. And we really, really get into that strange dynamic that happens in mixed families where racism is the reason why some of the trauma happens. Inner family racism. So at the time that I am posting this episode, we do not have a release date on the book. The cover is done. I've already seen it. I know that she's going into publishing soon, but the publisher themselves have not given her the actual date yet. And so I will update the show notes later on whenever I learn about what the date is. The episode will already be released. But if you want to come back and say, hey, I want to get this book, I will update the show notes to this episode in the future. And of course, I'll mention it in whatever intro I'm doing at the time that I get that news. So just want to put that out there. Oh, and at one point, there's a landline ring that goes on for about 15 seconds that I didn't stop the interview for. We just kept talking, partially because that was a very nostalgic ring for me. That was the same ringtone that I had as a child. With our landline, and I was just like, oh wow, that's kind of crazy that we're talking about what we're talking about right now, and this phone is ringing, so whatever, I left it in. Yeah, okay, I'm gonna go ahead and wrap this up and get into today's episode. Like I said, it was gonna be a little bit longer of an intro, but you know, we gotta do what we gotta do. Also, Be Your Mixed SF Anthology is still accepting submissions. Head on over to militantlymixed.com, click on the Be Your Mixed SF tab. Get the guidelines, get the submission information, do that all there. And now we're going to get into today's episode. So again, my guest today is Victoria Pendragon, author of the memoir Scorpio Times 10. And without further ado, please join me in welcoming our latest cousin to the Militantly Mixed family, Victoria. Today, I am joined by Victoria Pendragon. Victoria, why don't you introduce yourself to everybody and we'll get into it.
Hello, I am Victoria Pendragon. Technically speaking, I guess I'm the Reverend Victoria Pendragon because I am an ordained interfaith minister, which I took up because I, for many, many years, functioned as a hands-on healer. And that's a whole story in itself, but... That's my name is a chosen name because I needed to have my own identity. And I'm the oldest of 11 children.
Oh my gosh.
The daughter of two pathologists and the survivor of two fatal diseases. I think that sums it up.
I know we talked about it a little bit off air and we'll get into it, but just like, I mean... Two.
Yeah, you know, I got off on the right foot. I actually, the first one was when I was, my parents were pathologists, I mentioned. My mother caught tuberculosis right after giving birth to me.
Oh my gosh.
Because she, of course, didn't ever take off work. She never took off work, not her whole life. But she caught TB, and I was a baby. I got TB. And so because it was just assumed there was no cure for tuberculosis at the time, it was assumed that I would die. So they handed me over to a clinical trial, and they're just like, you know, here's our baby. And I got the good drugs.
Oh my gosh.
I lived.
Oh my gosh. So,
that's how I started. And also, I wasn't even, when I was breathing, I think I knew what was going to happen because I was born not breathing. I had to be revived.
Oh my gosh. One way or the other, you were either not going to be or you were really going to be.
Apparently.
Goodness gracious. I wonder if one of my maternal side aunts had tuberculosis as a child and still test positive for it, although didn't have the major health defects as a result. And it's probably because the clinical trial that you were delivered to that my aunt ended up being able to get through
the good drugs.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, could we also talk a little bit for a second about what your heritage is too for the?
Yes, let's. Okay. I had all my my DNA tested too by whatever company it is that does that. So I found out even more from that. Mm-hmm. But basically, my father was mixed because his father was a native Cuban.
Okay.
And in the DNA testing, they refer to that as Native American.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was Native American and Spanish. So he married a completely Spanish woman.
Mm.
And they gave birth to my father, who I guess technically was a mixed race person.
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, my mother, on the other hand, her whole thing is like, it just says Northern European. It's basically German.
Mm-hmm.
And however, some Welsh is thrown in there. And at the top of the list of what makes up the most of me in this DNA thing, it says Welsh, oddly.
Yeah, I'm a Welsh too.
Are you really?
Yeah.
So well, it felt natural to me when I wanted to change my name to take the name Pendragon, which comes out of that whole history. So.
And Welsh are the only people whose national flag has a mythical being on it, which is a dragon.
I never thought about that. It's true.
So my British side, I was telling you know, my dad's side is on one side black and white British, but that is a combination of Welsh and English. So they're darker haired, blue eyed. They also descend way, way back from like Spanish pirates and stuff like that. But they also have a name, Trahan, which is like dragon battler type of thing. You know, like dragons are very much a part of like the Welsh history. So while they did end up in England, like part of the Welsh part of them was still very heavy by the time it got to me. And so I'm only really just starting to like learn a little bit more about the Welsh because my nan had a very English identity, you know, and stuff like that. So, and a monarchist too. So there's that. But yeah, the Welsh is actually pretty heavy in the numbers for me as well. So that's your ethnicity. How do you identify yourself? Like if you were to.
I identify as. Hard to say. I don't think anybody ever asked me how I identify because I'm just such a melange, you know. I'm a stew.
Yeah.
I'm so all these different things, but I look and always have looked like a Cuban.
Yes, you definitely do have a Cuban look to you for sure.
Yeah.
For me, I like to. You know, give people room because I think in a lot of cases, and it's anybody because a lot of the folks that come to the show don't often get a chance to talk about mixedness. I mean, some do. You know, I have some professionally mixed folks on here, but some don't. And so I try to distinguish. Like, we have an ethnic identity, but we might not be able to have access to some of that, or you know, whatever. Like, you know, your Tahino past, probably it's there in your DNA and there's definitely things going on, but you may not, you know, the native aspects of where you come from, how much of it got passed down to you, you may not have that much access to it, but it's still there. It's still part of you. In my case, I mostly tell people my identity is Black Japanese and like white British. And I say white British versus, or I'll say colonizer British. I'll say that versus like English or Welsh, because I want to make it clear that like the cultural identity of Britishness is what I was raised in, not necessarily like a generic English or Welsh culture. And then my mom's white side is like a Appalachian, Scots, Irish, German type. Don't really know how they identified, to be honest. I think they identified as Appalachian. So whatever came from the old countries was gone by the time it got down to me. And so it's not a part of the way I identify, but it is a part of what I list. Like, this is what I know I am. Here's what I have access to, and here's how I identify. And I am making that available to myself opened up a lot of space for me to just like, it's okay if you don't have access to something. You can still be your mixed ass self without knowing everything, you know. So that's why I asked the question, actually, is because
I have a tendency to identify more as Cuban simply because that's why I had the childhood that I had, which was very unpleasant. And it was because my mother's father, who had been, he was one of these people that made, in the 20s, he made like a gazillion dollars and lost everything in the crash. And at the time of the crash, he had a house in Beverly Hills, a house on the Jersey Shore, and another house in the Pennsylvania mountains. So he was rich. And the only reason he let his daughter marry a Cuban was because my father's family had a boatload of money also. So
man, the let daughter marry sentence is heavy. That is a heavy, heavy
sentence. So he would never have let her marry someone of that ethnicity if they had not been loaded. But they were. However, that made interesting babies. My mother's first two babies were like me and my closest sister. So we were took after our father. Third girl, Germanic princess. I mean, golden curly hair, just absolutely lovely. Then five boys in a row. And some of them were, some looked more Spanish than others, you know, and others. And then two more girls who also looked very Cuban. And then just a little white boy. And so it was the whole family was a mirror of mixedness in so many ways, because like my skin tone was nothing like the third sister's. I was in the summer. I just got as brown as you can get, still do. And and she didn't even, I mean, she tanned, but you know, it wasn't the same. So it was interesting within the core of the family, just all the differences that there were between us. And because my closest sister and I, she's now deceased, because we were the first two, and because I like to call him my evil grandfather, because I didn't know my other grandfather, because he died when I'd never met him when he died. I was in high school, but I'd never met him. My grandfather, because he needed money to support the lifestyle to which he had become accustomed, he, first of all, got in a horrible automobile accident. He didn't cause it. He was in this accident, but maintained that he had been crippled by the accident. He had not. Everywhere he went in public, he went on crutches.
Nobody was speaking.
In his house, he hung them up on the wall and walked around. He was a horrible, horrible person. Wow. So when he saw his daughter give birth to these little Cuban girls, he wasn't exactly showing them off. However, he did sexually traffic us. And he would say, oh, can I have the girls for the weekend? And then the girls for the weekend got taken out to the woods and tied down and raped, essentially, by numerous men.
And he was making money off of
it. And he was making money off of it.
Goodness gracious.
And so he could support himself in the manner, not quite in the manner to which he'd become. He had to give up the house in Beverly Hills. But he kept the other two.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that affected my entire life.
Of course, yeah.
I don't know any other way to put it. I managed, my sister and I had two different responses to this. God bless her. I left my body. I don't know how I knew to do that as a child, but I guess it was just a thing that's there for people to access if they can. And I was like, I'm out of here. So my view of what happened was really a view of what happened. I got to see me. I got to see my sister and what was happening to us and what was below. And she would fight. And I would just, I left my body. So my body was just like, I didn't fight.
Were you, was this self-preservation, you think?
Oh, it was.
You were trying to do?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there was just, my body was overwhelmed.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, this is the only way out of this is getting out of this. And I literally, I have still the vivid memory of diving into the earth and swimming up into the trees. That was very cool.
Oh, so that was like how you were mentally processing the moment or what was happening in those, in those moments.
Yeah. And so she got thrown in the trunk and taken home in the trunk for acting up. And I got to lie in the back seat.
Oh my gosh. As a benefit for your behavior.
Yeah.
Goodness gracious. Good. Oh my gosh. So one of the things that we had talked about offline was that you recently have written a book about this experience, especially as it relates to the difference between how you and your browner sisters were treated versus your more white presenting sibling. Well, it's just, I assume it's just the girls then, the boys.
He wasn't interested in the boys at all.
And so he didn't even pay attention to them.
Nope, they didn't get invited down to the shore for weekends or anything.
Oh my goodness.
It's like they didn't exist.
I don't even know.
And the final two girls, though, really lucked out because they did look like my sister Debbie and I did. But what happened was, this is one of the best days of my life. I was handling the house for my mother. I was being the housekeeper because they couldn't find one. And I arrived at the house and she goes, and she tells me, she greeted me and she said, my father's in the hospital in Philadelphia and he's dying. And I was like, hot shit.
Great. Yeah, but, absolutely.
But I am going to go and make sure the bastard is dying. And meanwhile, my mother's going, it's such a shame because your two sisters, they were supposed to go visit this weekend. And I'm like, I have goose pimples I have goose pimples all over my body. I was so relieved.
Right.
Because what happened to us would never happen to them.
So that was probably when it was going to start. But
oh yeah. Oh,
it
for
hadn't
sure.
happened yet. Oh my goodness.
Because they were two Cubans, because the little curly haired blonde golden girl, she never went for that. That didn't happen. They took her for weekends, but they had pictures of her sitting on a cushion on a fur cushion with pearls draped around her neck. She was the queen.
And was it not strange that there weren't also pictures of you and your other sisters alongside her?
Yeah, you might think that if you were thinking, but my parents, gracious. I think, had a lot on their minds. I don't know.
Oh my gosh. So, I mean, yes, I agree that is like the best news ever. I shared a little that I also come from an abusive childhood. And when my father was dying, I had already said like goodbye to him a couple of years before he died. But when I got the call, when everybody was like, you know, he's dying, you got to go see him, I was like, I already said what I said to him when I was 17. I didn't need to do it again at 21. I chose not to go down because I was concerned that I would actually murder him.
I get that.
You know, like being in a vulnerable state, your whole childhood and stuff happening to you. And then you get a moment of seeing them in a vulnerable state. Like the way I fantasized about it, I was like, this is not a good thing for me. Cause I might just like, I don't know what's going to happen to me if I see him. So I ended up not going. The only thing I feel bad about is that I wasn't there for my brother, and my half siblings don't know me and I don't really know them either. So they also were spared. So they have a angelic view of the memory of their father and won't speak to me because I know the truth about my father. And since my brother blacked out a lot of what happened, nobody believes me. So, you know, so I'm a part, I'm the big bad scary wolf family member, like you and I were both saying earlier.
I have to say I was incested by my father. But he was kind. He was gentle. He approached it like I was his lover. I don't know what else to say. It's not right.
Yeah.
But it was kind and gentle, and it screwed me up for life. I think
more than fathom.
It was like the effects of that, I think, were actually more traumatic to me as far as relating to men went,
right,
than being raped in the woods.
Sure, yeah. Because so, this makes sense to me, because I know it sounds wild, but one is in violence and one isn't.
Right.
It's a different kind of violence. It's a different kind of violence, I guess.
But it was completely loving. It was, yeah, it was educational. It was gentle. It was, my mother knew what was going on, by the way. She knew what was happening.
We have some of that in my family as well.
I was, to me, it was a gift in so many ways. Actually, it's kind of interesting because I went on in my later life to become what's called a death doula. I just had a natural gift for helping people cross over,
mm-hmm,
meant that for allowing them to let go. And I got to do that with my dad. Mm. I got to help him let go. And that was, to me, it was the perfect ending.
Was there guilt on his part? Is that what he needed to let go? Or maybe you don't know.
Oh, he had a lot of things. He had a lot of guilt to let go of.
I'm like, I don't even know how to fathom.
Yeah, I wasn't the only issue in that man's life.
Sure. Oh my goodness. Is this also included in what you've written?
Yes.
Okay. So I think like one of the biggest aspects of like your mixedness, probably that we could be getting into here is just like literally your own biological grandfather viewed you as subhuman compared to the one he idolized. And in doing so, because he was able to view, like, again, a biological relative as an other, he could just do whatever. And how that shaped you as a human, how that shaped you as a person is all based off of this one guy's way of just being like, yeah, you're another to me.
And my sisters were too, my closest sister. I mean, that was, as I told you, she ended up being diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason she got diagnosed was because she kept going to the police. She had gone to college and she kept going to the police and telling them that men were after her. Men were chasing her. Men were hiding behind walls waiting to rape her. And she couldn't get it out of her head.
Mm.
And it was,
I mean, the boogeyman is literally around the corner your whole life. And then, so how do you adjust to that when you're out in the world? Like it makes sense as a trauma response that would have happened. So how did you manage, like, therapy? What made you a regular person?
Oh, therapy happened eventually, yes. But I one of the reasons my publishers wouldn't accept my autobiography was because there was just so much sex in it. Yeah. And that's because I acted out until I was, golly gee whiz, pretty old.
Yeah.
At 35, I became a Playboy bunny. Say, okay, this is not where you want to put somebody with a background like mine.
It's so accessible to people with backgrounds like yours.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was, I was into my 40s, I think, before I actually, this is what happened. I got this disease, diffuse progressive systemic sclerosis. And
this is number two of the two.
Yeah. Yeah.
Life-threatening.
It's the disease. One that made my hands be like this.
Mm-hmm.
But my whole body was like that. And I became a guinea pig again, just like I was when I was a little kid. And this time it was for a clinical trial for a technique called extracorporeal photopheresis, which means outside the body, extracorporeal. Photopheresis is this treatment that involves light, hence the photo bit. not sure what the phoresis refers to, but what they did was they took, to do this, they took once a month, every month for 2 days, I went to have these treatments, and they would put a big needle in my arm right here that extracted whole blood. So, you know, not like a regular little tiny needle. It's a decent sized thing. And the blood, the blood would come out of my body, and it would go into this big machine they called UVAR. And then it would cross, there were these lights that went in front of, I think, an ultraviolet light. And the blood would be exposed to that for a few hours. And then they would put it back into my body.
Okay, like a UV blast of the blood.
Yes. Okay. And if you've never had warm blood shot into your body, it's a rush. I will tell you, it's awesome. And so,
like physically, you can feel just like an energy or warm. Boost warm. Or something.
It's warm, so you That's can wow. you're like getting warmth injected into you. It's That's very wow. cool. So I was on this treatment for 3 years, I think. And I went every month. And the day of the last treatment, which I hadn't known would be the last, and they hadn't either, because nobody was getting better on this thing. Sometimes people would get better and they'd take them off and the people would die.
Oh, shit.
But I was making this amazing progress. I was like, except for I was normal again. And they were terrified to let me go for fear I would just, die, everything would come back and I would die. And so there was a lot of emotion around this. And my daughter came with me to be there at the last treatment. And they think they're all sending me home to die. So there's all this energy around it. And I got home. And my daughter was there waiting for me. And one of my sisters, who's a doctor. And she had told her, you know, what was happening. My daughter had told my sister what was happening. And I don't, to this day, I cannot remember what exactly triggered me, but I was standing in the parking lot outside my house talking to the two of them. And I said something about my grandfather being my evil grandfather. And she said something back about him. And I said, so I guess he never got you. And that's the last thing I remember saying. The next thing I remember, I was standing in the kitchen and there was like this movie reel playing of my whole life, of all the abuse of the stuff in the woods and the stuff with my grandfather. And it was just like my goose pimples when I'm talking about it. It was terrifying. And I immediately saw therapy.
that was the thing.
Because I'm like, what the heck? I couldn't even process it.
You like, did you feel it was buried before? And then it just like all hit you?
I had no clue. I had no clue. I just thought I was like impossible to control sexually. I just had no self-control.
So more kind of like blacking it out a little bit and just living a little wild life. And then...
Yes.
I got you.
And I would, and inevitably in those situations that I would put myself in that were so dangerous, they were dangerous. I could have been killed. And I knew that I could have been killed. And I did it anyway.
But you just can't account for like the way sexual trauma affects, you know, like, because I was raped at 12. And by a person in the neighborhood, a familiar person in the neighborhood. And I ended up telling a gang member that was in my neighborhood also, who was 23. Again, I was 12. Something happened to that guy. I don't know. All I know is that something happened. and then that same person, to help me, and I'm doing this in quotes, not be afraid of sex going forward, had sex with me to help me. Like you kind of said, it was kind and things like that. And for many, many years, I viewed it under that lens of this person helped me out. And then just one day in my mid 30s, it smacks me in the face. Oh my God, I was 12. You know, like they were a full grown ass man.
Yeah.
And it's complicated that it was both kind and creepy. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's so I have reframed it in my head now as a 45-year-old, you know, 45-year-old person, perspective, and, you know, 12 to however long I thought this was an okay thing that happened. I acted out too, though. You know, like, I had my period of time too. I was out on them streets. You can't account, like, your brain, what does your brain do? Like, it almost, like, it stops developing sense. You know, for a period of time. And then one day sense kind of smacks into you and you're just like, oh shit, I got some stuff to, I got some stuff to work on. Why am I having a panic attack while I'm driving? You know, like, all of a sudden. So yeah, I mean, just, you just can't like hold yourself. How do I want to say this? I mean, you have to get to a place where you can eventually hold yourself accountable and like process and stuff. But there's a period of time you probably actually cannot.
I think you cannot, especially if you're a child. I think it's just overwhelming.
Yeah.
And you can't scare.
And you almost need to see models in the world. And sometimes you don't see it until you're much older, of it not going that way and being like, oh, you mean I could have had a life that didn't include this, you know, horrific. And then and learning that, you're like, maybe I have some damage that I could probably talk to somebody about. So I am very pro therapy because I definitely became a far more functional person as a result of it. But there's, you know, there's a good chunk of time where self-preservation was shown in very strange ways.
I do.
I mean, I get it. And also, like, the way that I process, I mean, I do talk about different abuse and stuff like that a lot. I also make a lot of child abuse jokes, self-deprecating types of things too. And it's like part of the way, you know, like, clearly things still not all the way processed. And so I have to laugh my way through it so that I don't like fall apart, you know. It's all stuff I'm aware of, and yet still do it, you know. You get to it when you get to it, I guess, is kind of how I do it.
Yeah, it's interesting for me as a person who forgot everything to speak with someone who remembered and functioned.
Yeah.
It's and how different are, and yet how similar the end result.
Like, kind of the same path. Like, it's different, but some of the same things happen. Yeah. So like maybe, like, neurologically, something happening when, especially at that pivotal time, when you're in that puberty age of and stuff, and when things start, like, because you can abruptly go from non-sexualized to sexualized like that. I mean, I went away for summer school, like, summer, sixth grade, flat-chested, no shape to myself, whatever, actually made fun of being so underdeveloped compared to other people. Yeah, I went away for the summer. Like, I went from one parent to the other. And when I came back, I was a full, like, B cup. And I had curves. And I got attacked in the school locker room in seventh grade by other girls because they didn't believe I had developed. There was they couldn't conceive of the little, like, flat-chested person with nipple hills. You know, I had, like, little protruding nipples, and that was basically all I had. Could go from that to that. And, you know, plus all the boys started paying attention to me at that point. And so I became a threat in that respect, which, again, I'm just walking around just do. But in that period of time, that's when all this, like, sexualization started happening. And the way I charted through, like, I didn't forget anything. I remembered most of everything, I believe, that happened to me. I would seize up in different places. Like, if I drove past the place, or if I was in a car and we drove past the place, like, you know, my body would tense up and stuff like that. Even as an adult, I tested it out. I went back to that neighborhood and I, like, drove past just to see what would happen. I had people with me, and so I was able to kind of mask it a little bit because I had my now husband and one of my childhood friends with me. And I was like, yep, that's where it happened. You know, I know I was feeling things, but I was trying to mask my behavior because I didn't want to make these guys uncomfortable. You know, but I think, like, the way something happens and the way our brains develop after something like that. So we got to go down this acting out path, and something has to pull you out, because I know the other side of it. I have cousins who have very similar experiences to me, and they didn't make it in the same way. You know,
you say that, it's interesting to me. My mother, of course, knew what was going on with my father, and, mm-hmm. and was there and active at the in the project sometimes. But she actually, at some point, and I'm trying to remember when exactly it was, she turned over to me my records from the pediatrician that was seeing me at the time. So I have actual records of vaginal discharge and stuff like that at like age 5.
No kidding.
Yeah. So, I mean, and so the doctor knew, the doctor had to know this was going on.
That's the other thing. Like, there's so many adults that could have interceded at some point. Like,
yeah.
What the hell? Yeah. I mean, I think that's why, I know when we were talking offline, it was the concern, like, is this, can we get into this discussion? And for me, I don't want to shy away from discussions like this, because there's somebody else out there who's experiencing it and maybe not able to talk about it, or can't even fathom actually hearing people talk about it. And, and hopefully hearing, like, I mean, I know I just met you, but I feel like we're having a very functional conversation. We seem to be managing, you know, in whatever our life is. Doesn't mean that we don't have our dark paths and, you know, things get hard sometimes or whatever, that it backs up on us. But, you know, we're still able to actually communicate about it. And so hopefully someone who doesn't have that experience could hear this and maybe take those extra steps, or, you know, even just trying to be a safe person.
Definitely seek therapy, because
absolutely.
I was like knocking on therapist's door the minute everything came back, but I had my last session with a therapist around this about 6 years ago, and I actually it was done. You know, I had my last horrible nightmare 6 years
ago.
I have it in my diary somewhere that I wrote it down, but I didn't know it was going to be the last one, but it was. And I was in my dream. My poor husband, God bless him, he's the best man. I wake up to find myself like thrashing, trying in my head, I'm dreaming, and I'm trying to drag my sister behind me, and I'm running away from the men in the woods in this dream. I'm running through the woods. I've got away. I've got escaped. So I'm acting this out in my sleep.
Oh, and he's just watching your body just thrash around.
He threw himself on top of me, and he's going, "It's okay. It's okay. It's all right." He didn't know about any of this until that point.
Oh, he didn't. Okay. Because I was going to be like, throwing himself on top of you might could have triggered something, but he didn't know. Oh, so
no.
He was just trying to help you calm down.
And that was when I started getting therapists that were able to handle my story, because I had tried a number of therapists. Some of them didn't believe me.
One of them
said I was making shit up. I need the attention.
Also, like therapists who don't try to believe or actually tell you you're lying or you're wrong or something like that. And I mean, like, maybe you do have like a lying type thing or whatever. Maybe that's what you're getting treated for. But like, the thing that would make a person who has been abused conjure up, like, or even a regular person, like, just conjure up these things, this is not realistic things. I couldn't begin to understand how you could fake it.
I don't
know. What I'm saying?
And if you were faking it, I think a good therapist would know.
Right.
I think you could tell.
I've been told I was, you know, being stupid about something before from a therapist, and I just remember thinking, like, why did you take this job? if this is the way you're going to treat people who need empathy, you don't show up to therapy because you don't need someone to hear you, someone to understand, someone to help you process. I don't understand some people who choose to go into therapy and can't hear a person who is dealing with suffering at whatever level they're dealing with it. Like you, I don't feel like when I go to therapy now that I don't necessarily need to deal with the stuff from the past. Like, it's there, it's present. I've come to peace with it in however way I can, you know, like, it's never going to be undone. The thing happened. So it just is there. It's just a part of the makeup of how we are and stuff like that. But like, I don't need, like, you know, you had your last nightmare. I don't get tensed up in certain situations because it triggers a memory or something like that. It's just, it's more of just like, oh, that kind of reminds me of such and such. Maybe be a little bit more aware right now. You know, like, different things are present now that weren't present 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So for therapy, as long as you can find some. But yeah, like, there are some people who straight up can't handle, like, they need to specialize. You need to be able to be specialized in, like, childhood sexual trauma or child abuse or something.
I would think so. Although I'll tell you, one of the most, effective, I guess, one of the people who helped me move along through, like, the dregs, because I'd already been to regular therapists. Yeah. I went for an acupuncture session.
Oh, interesting. And
it was just supposed to be acupuncture. I was having trouble with my intestines. And that was it was that triggered the dream that I told you about. And I thought to myself, this woman is doing something to my body that my body is responding to.
Like, you had it all blocked up physically.
I went back to her. I saw her once a month for 2 or 3 years. And during the first, I would say, year and a half of that, we worked through all this stuff, came up and out one way and another. One time I was on the table and I hear this voice. It sounds like it's like way, you know, going, Victoria, where are you? And I heard the voice and I said, my body's lying on the table, I said, but I'm up on the ceiling somewhere. And I had literally left my body like I did when I was a kid.
So she was talking to you to, like, point. Noticing that you were checked out. Yep. And she was trying to bring you back into physically present. Yep. That's wild.
She was that good that she was hitting points that were allowing me to process and at the same time keep me present for the processing.
Therapy can happen in really weird places. You know, sometimes it's hearing someone else experience something, sometimes it's therapy, sometimes, like, for me, what I've noticed with, in terms of my depression, like, triggers, the things that really trigger major depression, I have been actively resting a little bit more. I'm still dealing with some guilt for resting, but I'm trying to work myself through it.
Please do.
But, like, being in a hammock or swimming lately is what I've been doing a lot because of where I moved. And I'm like, the therapy that's causing, like, I'm not having to talk to anybody. I'm just having to sit there and just be quiet with myself. I think it's the sensation of just hanging or whatever. I don't know, floating, whatever. Yeah. Like, that is a very calming thing. Like, you just have to find the thing, and it might be multiple things. You know, but once you get it, it really does help, like, you know, blow away some of that stuff. In writing your autobiography, was this another way of processing it, or was it more of just like, let's get this out into the world?
It was. It was like sort of wrapping things up and tying a ribbon on it. And I wanted, more than anything, and if this ever, I don't know why we're having difficulties with my publishers at the moment. It's been a horrible experience.
I'm sorry.
But on the back of the book, I have a little paragraph that says that I have written this book so that people who have been abused or have suffered at the hands of someone else will speak up and speak out and say their truth, because the abusers want you to not speak. They want you to be scared. They want you to be frightened. And the only way this kind of thing will stop is if all of us speak up.
Yeah.
And it says that on the back of the book. I'm very plain about why I wrote it.
Is the book titled? I realize.
Yeah, it's
called
Scorpio Times 10.
Okay. And so right now you did mention, like, something's going on with the publisher. You don't have a date yet or when.
Yeah, I don't have a date for release yet. Yeah.
So since we can't actually say where people can get it or anything on this episode, when you do find out, let me know, and then I'll mention it in a future intro of the show. But then I'll also update the show notes so that people can actually see a link.
Oh, thank you. That'd be great.
To this, because sometimes people don't listen to it like right when it comes out. Sometimes they dig back into the crate. So I want to make sure that I keep that link as active as possible.
Okay, I'll get that information to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing with me. I know that what we talked about was not the easiest thing to talk about, but you're one of the few people that I've spoken to about a subject like this where we didn't like melt down into tears and emotion, where we can actually just kind of like talk it out, like, so, you know, I guess to show people like you can experience something like this and you can still get to a place of being functional about it. And sometimes it does sound like I'm talking very removed from a thing. I might laugh a little bit way through it too, because that's the way I process stuff, you know. But like, for people that are out there that are hearing two people who have experienced some kind of childhood trauma, to be able to say like, I got to a place to be functional, knowing that this was my past and it doesn't have to be a part of every aspect of my life going forward. You know, I can find ways to function. And so I appreciate that you took time to share it with me, but also whatever is you're going to be sharing in your upcoming autobiography. Since we did talk about such a heavy topic, and since it did have a lot to do with just like your evil grandfather's view of you as different than the chosen grandchild, what is something that you actually really love about being mixed?
What I absolutely love the color of my skin, honestly. I had a feeling you might ask that, and I thought, well, what do I? And I thought, you know what? It's my skin. I love the color of my skin. I always I like it when it's like it is now and darker. I'm always sad when my tan starts to fade, because I get by the end of summer I get a good tan.
Yeah.
And when it starts to fade, I'm always disappointed. Probably why I decided to get some tattoos.
Nice.
I love that. I love the color of my skin.
I love that too. I also really like to be browner than I am. And when my winter coat comes in, I get real stressed out because I'm just like, it's not reflective of the me that's on the inside.
You know, when I was little, my mother, I don't know if I mentioned this, my mother referred to my skin tone as olive.
Mm.
It's an interesting choice, green.
It is strange. Like, I understand that they will refer to like Mediterranean people as like olive skin. Toned or whatever, skin, yeah. And maybe there is an undertone of green, but like, I don't think all of us that tan have a green undertone.
No, they're black olives, but that's really black.
Yeah, that's a different. Yeah. I think I have more red undertones myself, and so which stresses me out, because when I do get brown every now and then, there's a little bit of pink, and I'm like, it's not a sunburn. But as I've gotten older and as the ozone has depleted more, I do actually get sunburn now, which really makes me upset. I didn't get sunburn as a child, but it happens. It happens now. I just think it's like the white side of my ethnicity being racist against my own body. And I have to fight it from within. Why don't you tell people how they can find you on social media so that as the book starts to come out, people can actually see more and hear more about you.
I am on Facebook, of course. And Twitter, and I don't do the other one because this is not easy handling an iPhone.
Yeah. So for people who can't see, for people that can't see, Victoria's hands are like your fingers are kind of curled in, and it's static, right? You were stretching your hand out as much as it could. So for people who can't see right now, that is what is happening. You are still a painter though. You've made.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Cause this is the joke. Okay. This is the biggest joke. I am fully functionally ambidextrous. Not only can I write with both hands, I can write with both hands with a mirror, or I can write with both hands regularly.
Okay. I'm seriously not lying when I say this about the parallels between us. I was ambidextrous as a child, and they put me in class, and I learned like the writing backwards, writing through a mirror, writing both sides. And then we moved, and they didn't keep it going. So now it no longer looks the same. But I do some things left-handed and some things right-handed. And so people are always confused about what's my dominant hand. And my writing dominant hand is my right hand, but I do almost everything else left-handed.
Interesting. That's so funny.
It's strange that we have that kind of parallel. Like, this is like a yet another parallel. what is the handle that you have on Twitter? Is it just your name or?
I think it's Transformative RT. Okay. So it's like transformative art, but you know, it's transformative. And I think the R is capitalized. Transformative RT.
The letter R and the letter T.
And the letter T, yeah.
Okay. All right. I'll get that up on the internets so that they can check you out. But again, thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed speaking with you today, and hopefully we'll get more chance to chat again.
That'd be fun. That'd be fun. You can come visit sometime.
Yeah, actually, I'm really curious about your house. I definitely want to see that.
Yeah, and the whole neighborhood is.
Is it like? <It's different. laughs>
Militantly Mix is a Maine Hustle Media podcast, produced and hosted by me, Charmaine Fury. Music is by David Bogan, the One. You can follow us on social media on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Militantly Mixed. If you'd like to become a sponsor of Militantly Mixed, please go to patreon.com/militantlymixed for monthly sponsorship or paypal.me/militantlymixed for a one-time only donation. And if you like what you hear on Militantly Mixed, please subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to be your mixed-ass self. Maine Hustle Media. Turn your side hustle into your main hustle.